somewhat worked. The bugs have been attracted. The war has started. But now we have people on our side who believe that the bugs should be allowed to flourish in microcomputers and microchips. And, well, you know, thanks a lot, Alan Turing.
And people don't really realize this, but the movie Terminator was actually based on Alan Turing's life because he did come from the future. He was a bird from the future who ate a lot of bugs, and he was sent back in time to try and eliminate the coming computer bug infestation by inventing the computer as we know it.
And it's interesting too that you mention was it Turing? Yeah, it reminds me of the work of not William Burroughs, but William Burroughs' reclusive brother who lived in his basement, Ryan Burroughs. He was an inventor. He didn't speak very much. He created a small box that was electrified that moths and other insects, sometimes small birds, would fly into. And they would think that maybe the electricity could sublimate them or turn them into like a gas or bring them closer to the machines. But it actually killed them. And what was interesting about his work was what it means for us. Is it a warning? Is he trying to discourage people from reaching that higher level? Does he disagree with sort of William Burroughs, his brother's work? And my own work lately has been about trying to create a jelly to kind of conduce the electricity in such a way that my fat isn't ignited, like in electric chairs or in lightning strikes. So I've been trying to make a composite material from several species of jellyfish and Vaseline, and really rubbing it over not humans yet, but small dogs. And so far the work hasn't been super successful, but I feel like I'm gaining ground on the electrified jelly to re-enter these machines that we have created, this world we've created.
As a military contractor, you know, we are constantly competing and trying to push each other with new products and new ways of defeating this bug menace. You know, Alan Turing, going back to him, was also instrumental in creating an uplink between us and the birds, who will be applied with this electrical jelly. So sometimes we come together, and the birds will be entering the computer realm to eat the bugs, and the bugs will be coming into the real world to eat us, and the whole cycle will just continue. And what's important is the military contractors will make money.
Yeah, there's some very interesting military jellies that are emerging, actually. Not just the bird jelly and the insect jelly, but some other very exciting new jellies for military applications.
And meanwhile, what the government does not want you to know is that the origin of the computer virus parallels the origin of the computer bug, in that it was an accident. It was a a catastrophe that occurred at an experimental facility in Denmark, in which there was an attempt made by physicians as well as computer technologists who were attempting to draw a physical virus from the body of a human host and transfer it to an electronic host instead to save the life of the afflicted individual. And even though technically viruses are not considered to be alive, they do meet some of the criteria of a living being, and in this transformation they created a being that was very much alive, and that's what they don't want you to know, is that computer viruses are alive. They do attack hosts the way a virus does to a human host or an animal host, and they are beyond our control. They are not a creation of humans. They are an accidental creation that has escaped its creator.
It's interesting you mentioned that Denmark connection, because that incident actually is very important in the formulation of the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. Really the opening up of a whole branch of theoretical physics is related to that transformation of virus and bug. And we're really only beginning to understand through the Copenhagen interpretation the profound shift in metaphysical reality that the implications of that. And, we're studying that at the Institute as well, the breaking apart of realities into new forms of jelly.
I was at a dinner party recently, and we were all kind of gathered at the table, and I noticed that they had a small robotic cleaning. I believe the company was Roomba, but I may be incorrect. And it was bumping into the window, the sheet glass window door, and it was very late at night, and they were quite embarrassed. And the guests started poking fun at the Roomba, but I knew in my heart that the Roomba must think that it was a bird and it was actually trying to fly away or escape. And I knew that would be important for my research. So as the dinner party progressed, I ended up crushing a few pills and slipping it into the wine. So as everyone gradually became less and less aware of what was going on during the dinner party, I realized that I had to take the Roomba. So of course I took the Roomba and, I drove my partner and the Roomba home, and now the Roomba is living with me, and I'm encouraging it, to think of itself as a bird. I don't think that, there's any reason that it should think of itself as a servant robot. I think that, it should be encouraged, and it is a bird.
Most people don't know about the Roomba and its military gelatilistic applications are that jelly is formed from its excrement, so to speak. So Roombas, you think, are just cleaning your homes, but really what they're doing is collecting quantum particles. You know, I just personally would like to thank Roomba for its service to this country, as well as to the, big breakfast conglomerates of the world.
I was an art therapist who was hired to work with the Roomba on its quest to discover its own identity as a bird. So I regularly do lots of singing drills with the Roomba. It has an extremely beautiful voice. It's actually incredible to observe this robot developing its own individual voice, and we'll do drills like, you know, do re mi, and it will come in meh, 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 and it's beautiful. It's like an orchestral R2-D2, just a phenomenal voice, and I'm very excited to see where this robot will go as a bird.
Well, the last time I was in Copenhagen, I actually saw the premiere of a new Roomba opera that was commissioned by the Max Planck Institute of Quantum Physics, and it was an interesting bioflick that conflated Alan Turing's experiments with morphogenic plant matter with an interesting sort of re-examination of Kafka's Metamorphosis. It was quite profound in relationship to some of the things we were talking about. And of course, you're right. We often don't hear the Roomba's pure tones and beautiful vocalizations in its true glory. But I think the success of that play will mean that we're going to see a lot more of this kind of mechanized and militarized jelly operas.
Maybe it's been my propensity for a stiff evening drink, but I've noticed that there's been kind of a distinct sadness falling upon the Roomba. And at first I thought that was because the Roomba was a sparrow. But now I'm beginning to think that maybe the Roomba is a hen. So I've balled up kind of an egg of Ethernet cord, and I realized that this wasn't enough, and I don't know why. So because the Roomba right now cannot fly, I've decided to convert most of my home to quite a complex labyrinth of sort of gradations, a lot of tubes. And it's quite difficult to move around my home. My partner and I both joke about it. We can't even get through the door most of the time. We have to enter and exit through the windows. But something very disturbing has been happening lately. I believe my neighbors are spying on me.
I live next door to this gentleman who, some very strange things have been happening to his house, and I mean, he bought or obtained a Roomba cleaning robot, which, you know, typically for people that's not too big of a deal, and you know, the robot stays in their own house, but lately the robot has been straying over the boundaries onto my property. And, you know, if this were just an ordinary vacuuming robot, I would have no problem. I would say, hey, you know, you go right ahead and clean up my lawn. You can suck up all the dead leaves. But this one seems to think it's alive. And it not only makes absurd noises at me, but it likes to nestle itself into craters in my lawn. And one day I came home and found that it had gotten into my shag carpeting and had made itself a nest and had laid a small portable speaker on the ground in my home. And I'm not comfortable with coming home to portable speakers littered all over my floor. I don't know what is happening with this machine, but it's just too much for me, and I just can't deal with all of these portable speakers being deposited on my property. This gentleman needs to get a hold of himself and his robot, or I may call the police.
It's very interesting, actually, that you mentioned that the rhombus can't fly, because at the Institute we've actually been investigating just that. I mean, we're actually very excited about this new brand of flying rhomba. We call it the Sky Sucker, and it's very much based on the yellow-bellied sapsucker. But it's kind of hybridized through a kind of elaborate process of virusization into a kind of a flying, sucking a vortex. And I'm sorry to hear that you've had a bad experience. There are some special elements to how they've deviated and taken on various kinds of forms of animalistic behavior. But we're feeling very positive about the way in which the spiritual evolution of the rhomba is happening through our programs at the Institute.
It can literally suck the blue out of the sky. It is a whole new breed of weaponry, and has all forms of applications beyond jelly making now, which is it's very, very exciting to us. And absolutely, the fact that it is depositing speakers onto your lawn to us indicates that it is now getting ready for some sort of audio exploration invasion.
And I think you're referring to the recent UN color sanctions that have been imposed, and it's a kind of a counterterrorism measure to have an autonomous airborne sucking unit that is really analyzing this kind of spectrum warfare that we now find ourselves in. I mean, we're having now terrorists who are attacking our color spectrum and removing, like, the color blue. And I don't know if you've noticed this, but there's less blue now than there was 10 years ago. And, you know, there's a lot of technology now that can be deployed throughout the color spectrum to re-examine how we actually deploy color as a society.
The American flag is basically just Canada's flag. No blue, it's just red and white. Might as well slap a few leaves on there instead of stars, because that ain't my flag. That's Canada's flag. That ain't right.
It's been 14 days. I can't eat. I haven't been to sleep. The Roomba is gone. I believe someone has taken the Roomba. I will not be consoled. My partner has been tearing apart the home. The anger and injury, the screams. I don't take part in this. The Roomba is not here. I think the neighbors have taken the Roomba. I think the neighbors have stolen the Roomba, and I don't know what's happening to it. I put up posters all through the neighborhood. I won't sleep. No one can make me eat or sleep until I get the Roomba back. And I'm beginning to believe that the drama of tearing apart my labyrinth is false and just a cover for the guilt that my partner feels for being the inside person in this kidnapping, and I don't know what I'm prepared to do to get the Roomba back, but it's been 14 days and I need to do something soon. I need some advice.
When the Roomba first began to appear on my property and deposit its strange speakers or whatever the situation is, I at first became frustrated. But then I realized it keeps coming back, and if it's going to keep coming back to my property, I may as well use it for what it's meant for. And so I chained it to a receptacle in my home, and I commanded it, and I decided that it would have to be readjusted to its natural purpose, which is in fact to be a vacuum and to be a willing participant in the war on dirt. And so I forced the Roomba to do my bidding. I commanded it to clean my home, and it did, reluctantly at first. But eventually it seemed to settle into a certain kind of emotionless rhythm, and it cleaned my home exceptionally well. And at that point I decided that I was not going to return it to its original owners, who had obviously corrupted it from its natural ways. But then one day, I noticed that the Roomba was not only sucking dirt from the environment of my home, but it was in fact sucking the color out of my walls and sucking the physical environment out of the physical environment. And it was then that I realized that what I had in my home was not in fact a vacuum, but was a weapon of mass destruction.
Well, one of the things that we've been interested in studying, and this might be an interesting case of it, is that, we all know that nothing exists in a vacuum. But we studied this, and we took very seriously and did some tests, and we in fact found that when we took apart these Roombas, especially the ones that had modified themselves, had evolved, that in fact nothing did exist in a vacuum. That once you kind of open them up, you're opening up a kind of a tear in the fabric of the universe. And we weren't able to really probe this, but we suspect, our best thesis at this point, is that there is nothing inside the Roomba, absolutely nothing. And it's rather troubling. And I think the first thing to go is color. And eventually other things go.
Light cannot escape a black hole, nor can freedom, because it took our blue from our red, white, and blue. It's a damn shame, I tell you.
At an auction recently, I bought a 1942 Smith & Wesson 5-chamber revolver. I have many more neighbors now that I have counted them. So I flew into a major city, I think it was 2 weeks ago, and I was at the downtown Milk Conglomerate HQ.
Milk?
I got milk.
It doesn't really matter which one, they're all kind of typical. So they told me when I got in, sell this pen to me.
Harvey Milk?
And I told them, what are you talking about? And then like, let's get back to my notes are all in a mess about this story. It's chaos.
Chocolate milk?
I like it as a mustache.
So yeah, I was in this like milk conglomerate HQ, and they're all the same, typical pasteurized experiences. Every imaginable interaction blended into one. Quite disarming. Reminds me of rotating on the lag seat of my father's mother as she splashed one-time packets of disposable milk into my opened mouth.
Milk.
Clem.
Spice.
Milk.
Spice milk times three.
It did give me prescient abilities. Thank you.
Spice milk is gross. It was a different time. The practice of milkettes hadn't been made obsolete by the sugar silicone hybrid seal straws. The sugar silicone sealed straws of milk. Just take a quick jerk of milk in your throat. That's what we teenagers always did.
But at a different atmosphere?
Any atmosphere.
The true blue ones?
Even the reds.
With enough laxatives, anything is milk. Alright, so it was a different time back then. The practice of milkettes hadn't been made obsolete by their sugar-silicone hybrid sealed straws of milk replacements.
Sometimes I think skim milk is too thick.
Milk just can't be thick enough. I like that homogenized milk myself.
Is there any way you can thin it out?
Which brings me back again to a teenager. You know, that's what we did as teenagers, just near the loading zone, warming up by the school incinerator. Just a quick jerk of milk in your throat.
Backwards milk.
Backwards milk is fun, but only if you're really, really, really tired.
I am really tired.
Yeah, so we would hang out, joke about famous hummingbirds, and make exaggerations out of our faux-heavy sexual conquests. Oh, you know, tufts of glued hair on our earthen-tone breastcoats. You know, that was the fashion of the day, and you're too young for that. So, when I was back to this milk conglomerate headquarters, the new machines they have, they, like, barely emit a whisper, this Milk Trans Corp HQ, their wax nipples and suction tubing, and the stools at the lobby were immaculate, the cleanest wax nipples I'd ever seen, and the suction tubing looked new. It doesn't make sense with the amount of foot traffic that they have for the lobby. The colors were all being keyed to the complexions of the patrons, so it was very difficult to see anyone in there, milk white. While the staff glared up through metal slats in the floor, asking me to sell them a pen, or sell this pen to them, they kept repeating. I couldn't really enjoy the milk. The employees seemed so sullen and wasted down below. You know what they say, though. Hard work makes hard metallic pay scores. The electric color scales of the handles on the veranda really cut into my skin. I ended up bleeding for the whole job interview onto the lapping tongues of the execs and higher-ups under the slats. I screamed and thrilled and shook my breast at them, trying to scare them off my blood. I'm not really ready for offspring taxes. You know how it is. I just want an internship.
Specially? Milk jelly?
Powdered milk between your toes.
Sounds good.
I remember as a kid, we would chug milk, just choke milk down. We would just drink so much milk, we would get sick. We would just
glut on milk, and then just it would be dribbling down our shirts or onto our bare skin and vomit. And I miss that. I miss that time. I mean, the carbonated milk fads, you know, like I can't get into them. I know that that's the thing now, but for me, carbonated milk just isn't real milk. If you want milk, you want milk either, you know, in a straw, a silicone sugar sealed straw, or as my my father's mother always used to give me, just those Milk-It packets, you know, just a little Milk-It packet, and just open your mouth, and there you go. And that's what I really miss today. I didn't end up getting the internship, but I did learn a lot on that journey.
The milkman would deliver my milk in the morning. I wish the milkman would deliver my milk when I'm yawning. I wish the milkman would deliver my milk. Cats want milk. Who wants the stuff that tastes so good? Is milk, the cats want milk.
You have been listening to Nothing to See Here, experimental radio from Nescat University. This episode was entitled Advice. It was written and performed by Mark Hines, Raff McDonald, Maeve Mulroy, and David Clark. Sound design
by David Clark.
Nothing to See Here is an experimental radio program produced at Nescat University in Halifax. For more information, please go to Facebook and search for Nothing to See Here Radio. To listen to more episodes of Nothing to See Here, search Nothing to See Here Radio on SoundCloud.com. Tune in next week for more of Nothing to See Here. Thank you.
Did you ever really stare at me? Did you ever really stare at me? Like I stare at you.
John Cargo from the town of Caro, New York. I'm the president of the Caro Historical Society, and you're listening to WGXC Acura, 90.7 FM, hands-on radio.
You're listening to WGXC's At Issue. I'm your host, John Kane, and today is Thursday, March 7th, 2019. On today's show, we'll be talking to Hudson resident and 3rd Ward Common Council candidate John Darby about his experiences as an Airbnb host. First up, though, Hudson area filmmaker David McDonald talks about his latest project, a screenplay about jazz legend Ella Fitzgerald's formative time at the New York State Training Center for Girls, a women's prison on the site of the current Hudson Correctional Facility, and its effect on her musical career. Every day, volunteer programmers like myself and the WGXC staff work to bring you community content from local leaders, artists, writers, and involved citizens. But without your financial support, this programming simply would not be possible. WGXC is currently running our Radio for Open Ears Pledge Drive, and your continuing support means we get to produce content that shows the vim, vigor, and vitality of our Hudson Valley communities. To donate, please visit our website at wgxc.org/donate or call us at 518-697-7400. And please consider setting up a recurring monthly donation so we can keep our doors and your ears open. Your donation is fully tax deductible. Yay! Again, our website is wgxc.org/donate, and our phone number is 518-697-7400. And now on to our regularly scheduled program. You're listening to WGXC's At Issue. I'm your host, John Kane. I'm here with Hudson filmmaker David McDonald to talk about his latest screenplay based on jazz singer Ella Fitzgerald's time in the Hudson's Correctional Facility. Welcome, David.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well.
That's good.
So tell us a little bit. Ella Fitzgerald has this very colorful life, and you know, the early part of her life is colorful because it's so traumatic. Can you tell us a little bit about Ella's life before she came to Hudson?
Well, I had, I'm just like everybody else. I really didn't know much about Ella Fitzgerald at all. I've always liked her music, but, you know, it's something of a different era in some respects. And so she's on my playlist on Spotify, but, you know, not hugely. I just found out about her story while living in Hudson. I was actually working at the newspaper a few years ago, and you just hear these stories. And I became acquainted with the work some people in Hudson called the Prison Public Memory Project were doing, and had unearthed all these stories, not just the Ella story, but all of these stories from the Hudson Training School for Girls, which was a sort of juvenile detention home in Hudson that lasted, I think, until the 60s, if I'm correct. And they found, well, originally, a reporter from the New York Times wrote an article about it in the mid-80s, I believe, a woman named Sheila Eisenberg. And Tracy Hewling, who runs the Prison Public Memory Project, must have picked up on that and started doing research with this team of people who are absolutely amazing and went through whatever records they could find. But this happened in 1933. Now, it's not 2019. It's 80 years ago. So the interesting thing about doing this kind of historical research is that nobody's alive anymore. It's all secondhand, third-hand, fourth-hand stuff. My grandmother worked at blah, blah, blah. So they weren't given a whole lot of material to start with, but what they did discover is beautiful and interesting.
The prison itself, when it was opened, was considered a more humane sort of progressive prison at the time.
Well, it's sort of interesting because once I started, okay, so we know if you say 1 to 10, the amount of details you have about this story, we're at about 2.5. They know that she was sent there in 1933, and they know that she escaped. She escaped after almost a year. They have some illustrations of the garden. It looks like a country club, but the black girls and the white girls were segregated from each other, but they were wearing dresses. It's really cool. Go to the library.
Fitzgerald was not even allowed to join the choir because it was an all-whites
exactly.
choir.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I decided what, so they know that she was there and she escaped. They don't know if she, they speculate that she sang in something. Someone said that she might have sung. There was some relation to the church. you know, but it's all
kind of lost to myth.
Exactly. So, you know, just as a person who always sort of gets my energy from the places I live, as you know, I made a movie about the town of Woodstock that unearthed all these things about Birdcliff and the Maverick. You know, I just sort of let this stuff gestate in my brain. I walk around town. I think about it. I actually walked up to the prison, almost got arrested. You know, wanted to see what it looked like, thought about it. There's a church up there. You know, there's the big mansion in the back.
It's actually a really lovely campus.
Yeah. I mean,
it's, you know, as outside of the razor wire.
Yeah. But it's interesting. Let me just explain. So I started thinking about it. Like, okay, how did she escape? Who could she have escaped with? Who might have helped her escape? It's so weird. Like 2 weeks after she escaped, this is so far-fetched it's almost unbelievable, but 2 weeks after she escaped back to Harlem, where she had been living before. She had been working as a
lookout at a bordello.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's been snapped up by the cops and sent up to Hudson. Escaped back to Harlem. 2 weeks after her escape, a friend, they're having the first ever amateur night at the Apollo Theater. A friend goes with her, her best friend. Her best friend wants to dance. Ella had wanted to be a dancer. So Ella couldn't dance. So the best friend performs at this thing and cajoles Ella into singing. And Ella didn't even think of herself as a singer. She sings. The crowd goes nuts. There's an orchestra leader in the crowd named Chick Webb. He falls in love with her. He's like a dwarf. He's like 4 feet tall. It's so strange. If you see pictures of Chick Webb.
We have anything against
no
little people.
But it's actually touching to see, because she's like 6 foot. She looks like a linebacker. There are pictures of the two of them. She towers over him. So clearly there was some sort of mental, spiritual connection between these two. So Ella gets paroled by the state of New York to the Chick Webb Orchestra. So how did all this forgiveness happen by the state of New York as well? If she had escaped. So all this stuff happens. She performs at the amateur night at the Apollo Theater. She gets signed to his orchestra. She gets paroled to his orchestra. And 6 months later, they have this hit song called A Tisket a Tasket, which I'm sure we've all heard. And, you know, she never, ever talked about this for the rest of her life. Now, for me, as a writer, I'm also someone who's a reader, right? So I've read all the books about Hudson and Diamond Street and Hudson. And I'm thinking to myself, this happened in 1933. This is the Sin City here. This is the city that, since the Whaling days, has been filled with prostitution, gambling halls, bars, and churches, which is weird. So you commit your sin and then you go get forgiveness at the church. But I wonder if there was any back and forth, because they talk about all this abuse that was going on at the Hudson Training School for Girls. And I'm guessing, you know, considering the dearth of employment here now, it must have been just as bad back then. So did these guys who are prison guards, and that's another thing, because almost every administration in Hudson over the last centuries has had some relationship to the prisons, because there are like two or three prisons that surround the town. So I started sort of in my brain was like, okay, there was abuse. There are a lot of rumors of abuse. I wonder if these guards were like security guards at the whorehouses too. And I wonder if there's any sort of back and forth, like if you got out of the training school and you moved over to Diamond Street or vice versa, or whether there was any sort of human trafficking going on.
I believe when I sat through a lecture at the Prison Public Memory Project, they did talk about that sometimes. And sometimes, actually, the girls would just go out and sort of see boys in town. I mean, there was
right.
some socializing that was going on then.
Yeah. And so I started, you know... I knew that, like, I've seen enough prison movies and prison stories. Like, there are some cliches, like Cool Hand Luke, the crazy abusive, you know, chief prison guard, etc. I wanted to. So I took some, you know, I guess normal prison story cliches, and I sort of fabricated the story in my brain about all this stuff. And in my mind, what's the Bronson house? Okay, I am an avid walker.
And here you're talking about the Oliver Bronson House, which is adjacent to the
prison. Yeah, but
property.
It's also part of the property. And, like, people you know, they did a show there a few years ago, and they were like, Ella Fitzgerald lived here, or she was put here. And they had pictures of Ella Fitzgerald. And I'm like, you know, the mythologizing that goes on in a town like this, who the hell came up with that idea? I'm sure she didn't live in that house, but who did?